Ads, schmads. If you don't want ads, that's okay. Choose the Dave McWilliams Plus option on Apple Podcasts. And hey presto, no ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How you doing there? It is time for the podcast. This podcast today is going to be on the very strange observation that I have made over the last while, which is, why do rich people live in houses that were built for poor people? That is our podcast today, John. And it is a long odyssey we are going on.
I would expect nothing less.
We are going to start with Nathan Rothschild and we're going to end in Harold's Cross. And in between, we are going to meander down tributaries that may well seem, at first blush, not necessarily linked, but they are all going to be part of a giant mosaic. And that giant mosaic is going to explain a beautiful thing, a beautiful thing. But I see that you've had and your barn is cut off.
Yes, I did. I'm very good of you to notice, Mac. I was well overdue a cut. But I went to a new barber actually this time, Mac. It was one of those of the many Grafton barbers, but there's one that opened in Monkstown. So I decided, I was passing by, I'll jump in. And I arrived in there and there was three lads, you know, 17, 18-year-olds on the three seats. So I was waiting. And then this other dude came in, you know, about our age, silver foxy hair, cool-looking dude. And we're just sitting there. And one of the lads turns around and he just had lumps taken out of the side of his head. You know, this mullet job.
Yeah.
You know, shaved on the side.
Kind of a rugby jock mullet.
Totally, totally. Yeah. And he's going, yeah, love that. Oh, yeah, love. Really like the cut there. And both of us are looking at each other going, what the, Jesus Christ. Anyway, the lads finish up and go off and they're paying at the counter. And the barber says, next. And I jumped up in the chair and the other guy jumped up in the other chair. And the guy says, so what can I do for you today? And I looked at him and said, not that anyway. And the other guy was exactly the same. Going, what is with this? Rugby haircuts. Mullet was never cool.
But it's funny, I do remember, speaking of barbers, when you talk about barbers jumping up on the chair. When I was a kid, I used to go to Don McClure, who was the barber in Dalkey with my dad. And Don McClure cut my hair, my dad's hair, and my granddad's hair. That's how long he was knocking around there.
Your dad didn't have much hair now, in fairness.
Desi didn't have very much hair, right? But my granddad, Robert, Scottish granddad, apparently had a ponytail in the 1950s, which I find bizarre and really out of character. Really out of character.
Wow.
So Dom told me all this, but the fascinating thing is, when I was a kid, we had this big, as you remember, big red, it was like a fro. You could stick a pencil in it and it would stick there, right? It was like a big mic, big red mic.
Like your head was on fire.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, I hated it and I wanted my hair to be black like everybody else's, you know?
Yeah.
You know, Lee Majors didn't have red hair. You know what I mean? Like back then. Captain Kirk didn't have red hair. I didn't want to.
Starsky didn't have red hair.
There was no red hair pop stars either, right? David Bowie would actually go flaming red for the crack. But you didn't want to be David Bowie when you were nine, because that was far too androgynous, right? So nobody, no footballers apart from David Fairclough had red hair. Super sub from Liverpool. So I used to go to Dom every Saturday with my dad, and I'd say, when is my hair going to go black? And he'd say, don't worry, son. And he'd remember this hair oil, and he'd put a bit of hair on, an Old Spice or something.
Yeah.
He'd rub it in my hair. And I would go off thinking my hair was going to go black.
Yeah. I'll wake up in the morning and be black.
Yeah, exactly. And it's the way you said hop up in the chair there, because that's what you always had to hop up in the chair there, son. And the amazing thing, on the barber's chair, you had a plank for kids. So you'd hop up the plank that was being held by the two arms. But we will relate all this, John, to Nathan Rothschild, to houses at Harold's Cross, to why rich people live in houses that were built for poor people, and why there's been an explosion in Turkish barbers and the Grafton barber all around Ireland. That's a pretty that's a pretty good podcast.
Go on.
Nathan Rothschild, John, in 1824, just after the Napoleonic War, Nathan Rothschild was so wealthy, imagine this, that he personally bailed out the Bank of England.
Wow.
So the Bank of England is a chartered
company. Spare change, was it?
With his spare change, right? He was the richest man in the world. He had absolutely everything. He had become enormously wealthy due to his use of pigeons, which is an amazing thing.
You got to explain that one to me.
Okay, so Nathan Rothschild understood that information is money. The person who has the first information, the best information, the quickest information can make decisions and outfox everybody else.
Yeah.
Fascinatingly.
This is like the Sam Bankman-Fried stuff. That's what he traded on as well.
Exactly. So the quickest way from the continent to England with news was with pigeons. Because they flew quicker than the boats going across the channel.
Yeah.
So Rothschild, during the Battle of Waterloo, there was an enormous fear in England that Napoleon was going to win. And had Napoleon won, British gilts, i.e. IOUs issued by the British government, would not have been paid because the Brits would have lost and they would have no empire and they would have no money.
Yeah.
Okay. So the market in England was speculating on an English loss, because up until the very, very end, Napoleon looked like he was going to win.
Mm.
Rothschild, on the other hand, got information from the battle at Waterloo, from the actual scene, that the Prussians had come in late on the side of the Brits and they were swinging the entire battle for the Brits. This is where Nassau Street comes from.
Okay.
The Nassaus were a German family that swung the Battle of Waterloo in the Brits' favour. That's why we have Nassau Street. But that's, again, a different thing. Right.
Okay. I didn't know that one. That's a good one.
So the pigeon goes back to London with information saying, actually, the Brits are going to win. And Nathan Rothschild, what does he do? He buys up every single bit of English government debt when it's been really lowly priced. When the market thinks that they're going to lose, he gets information that they're going to win. And Bob's your uncle, he makes a fortune. That's one of his many, many apocryphal tales of how he won, right? Incredibly rich guy. Incredibly rich.
Pigeon net.
A pigeon net, exactly. Isn't that amazing, right? High frequency trading a la pigeon. So he was, as they call in Dublin, a pigeon fancier.
Yeah.
Because you know, a fella who breeds pigeons is a pigeon fancier. So Nathan Rothschild was a pigeon fancier. Now, richest man in the world, has everything he's ever wanted, can buy anything. And yet, in 1836, at the age of 56, he dies. He dies of an abscess. Now, that, an abscess, problem with an abscess, you know and I know, can be cured today with basic antibiotics that are available to everybody.
Sure. Yeah.
So here we have the richest man in the world now was killed by a disease that will be treated for the poorest man in the world at almost no cost in almost every single health service. That is what we call progress. That is what economic growth does for us, right? It makes more things available to more people than ever before at a lower price. And this has all got to do with the productivity of science, all that sort of stuff. And if Rothschild were alive today, he would bite your hand off for your flat screen television, for your iPhone. No, not my telly. That's just unpriceable. Too big. But he would give you half of Italy for a flat screen television, for an iPhone, for orthodontics, for all the things that we take for granted now. All those things in the past, take, for example, travel, right? I've been just reading something about Lord Byron, John, as you do. An absolute loon. I was listening to The Restless History, a great podcast about Byron. This is a fella who had an incestuous relationship with his sister, right? He was really out there. I know, it's massive. It's the darkness.
You're in danger of going off down a particular rabbit hole, which would be crazy, actually. We save it for another time.
I want to tell you that he was traveling around Europe. And travel in the old days was reserved for the very, very rich.
Yeah, yeah.
The idea that you would go to travel for fun was only for very, very rich people. You go into Dublin Airport today, and Dublin Airport is probably the most democratic public space in Ireland. You've got poor, you've got rich, you've got young, you've got old. Everyone travels now because of Ryanair.
Yes,
so
yeah, yeah.
Things that used to be the preserve of the very, very rich have now become commonplace for the very poor or the average guy. That's a normal idea, and it's called progress. And that is what we should be all aspiring to. So, for example, take literacy. Irish people have become much more literate. Take third-level education. We've much more third-level education. At the beginning of our state, the average life expectancy for blokes was about 55. It is now about 81. So we've actually gained 3 decades of life in a short period. So on almost every metric, what you can see is things that used to be the preserve of the wealthy, you know, travel, education, health, all that sort of stuff, have all become now attainable for everybody.
Yeah.
So the poor now have the accoutrements of the rich, which is why in the old days, you go into a fancy barber and having a facial and having a haircut, right? And those been springing up all over the place. That used to be the preserve of the wealthy, the reasonably wealthy. Yeah.
The hot towels, the whole shebang.
The hot towels and all that sort of stuff. Except in one area. And this is a fascinating thing, because right now, all over the Western world, but particularly in Ireland and Britain, the rich are living in houses that were built for the poor. And it shows that the great progress of economic growth has broken down in housing. So the rich are now living in former council houses, former artisan cottages that were built explicitly for poor people. And the question is, why is that? What does this tell us about housing? And what does it tell us about the way we structure our economy? That's what this is all about, John. So I want to go from Nathan Rothschild to Harold's Cross. Harold's Cross, for our non-Irish listeners, is a old working class area of Dublin. And when I say working class, it was explicitly set up for the working class, because Dublin had a massive housing crisis after the famine. And the reason it had a massive housing crisis after the famine was that Dublin turned into a refugee camp. So if you can imagine, you know, basically tens of thousands of starving people from Galway, from Donegal, from Cork, from Kerry, from Clare, from the whole Western seaboard that was decimated by the famine, turned up in Dublin, and they would know where to live. They'd know where to live. And the tenements then filled up, and there's cholera outbreaks and all that sort of stuff. So in 1866, John, in response to this housing crisis, an act was enacted called the Dublin Artisans and Labour's Dwelling Act. Yeah. And it was specifically an act that underpinned the legal basis for a company called the Dublin Artisans and Labour's Dwelling Company to build houses for poor people.
And that's a snappy title, but who brought in this act?
Now, it's very interesting. This was brought in by Quakers. Quakers and the Guinness family. The Guinness family and prominent Quakers, on a humanitarian basis on the one hand, but also on the basis that these people were their workers. And they said, hold on a second, we can't have our workers living in tenements. We have to provide decent sanitation for these people. We have to provide decent transport. Imagine this. So Harold's Cross, you probably know the cottages in Harold's Cross. If you look at the labourers' cottages in Harold's Cross, they're still there now. But let's go back to when they were built. So they were built explicitly for very poor people. Not only were they built for very poor people, they were rented extremely cheaply, because Dublin Corporation offers the sites to this company at discounted rates. They reduced ground rent for these places. So they said, we are going to build houses for poor people. Now, it's an amazing thing. They also built a tram to Harold's Cross to transport these people.
Right, okay.
So the old Dublin tram network, Harold's Cross, was one of the major intersections.
Yeah.
So they've got cheap houses, cheap public transport, financed by a company which was legally enshrined by an act. So it was incredibly well developed, incredibly well thought out in response to, in effect, a refugee crisis. And that refugee crisis were the people from the famine. And they were obsessed by keeping rents low. So I'll give you quotes. All these houses were built around 1870s, 1880s, right? And this is like the houses in Portobello, the houses in Harold's Cross, the houses all around South Circular Road, Phibsborough, some parts of Cabra, some parts of Drumcondra.
By the way,
for those of you who are not Irish, these are just all inner city suburbs now of Dublin. But the point was, these were houses built for poor people. In 1906, a report in the Irish Independent commented on about rent. And I quote, it says, "Labourers and artisans must be in receipt of very good wages to pay these rents. How can a man in receipt of 18 shillings a week, with himself, his wife, his four kids to feed, cloth and pay society money, give 6 to 8 shillings a week in rent?" So they were outraged that a man on the minimum wage would have to forfeit about 30% of his take-home pay on rent. This was a big, big deal.
Yeah, right? Not much has changed, has it?
Now, listen to this. Not only has not much changed, it's changed completely, because these were men on the minimum wage, were in those cottages in Harold's Cross, and they and the good burghers of Dublin were complaining about how the man had to pay 30% of his take-home income on rent. This was bad.
Mm.
If you look at today, if you go on daft.ie and you go to the Harold's Cross cottages, which are still there and they're still being rented out, they are rented out today for €1,558 a month, right? That's the rent there. The minimum wage worker today is taking home €1,700 a month, which means that the man on the minimum wage in Ireland is spending almost 100% of his income on rent. In 1906, when it was suggested the man on the minimum wage pays 30% of his income, people were up in arms. Now, imagine that.
Yeah.
So everything else has fallen in price. Medicine. Like, think about it. Back to Rothschild.
Yeah.
Medicine that was not available to Rothschild is available to the poorest person in Ireland today. But houses that were available to the poorest person in Ireland today are out of the league of anyone on the minimum wage. So there's been a massive, massive change. And we're going to come back to rich people are living in poor people's houses, because the only people who can live in the houses that were built for poor people are rich people. So look, even consider a 30-something couple, right? You know, people coming back from a stint in London, they have a few quid in their back pocket. What I'm talking about is people in the top 5% of income in the country. I know this sounds extreme, but I want to put into perspective just how quite mad the housing market is, right? So let's say the fella is a software engineer down in one of the tech companies, right? And his missus is a corporate lawyer. So these are doing very well. They've got experience in London. They're coming back to have kids, to come back to Ireland, all that stuff. So they have a combined income. Could you imagine this? I'm making this up as people, right? These are representative of about €200,000 a year. So that's more or less the top 5% of earners, right?
Absolutely, okay?
Right? So think about those, right? In the last 2 years, there has been a dramatic increase in the amount of young, rich people in Ireland. Figures are there has been a 112% increase in the number of what they call tax units, awful expression, which is couples, whether they're male, female, 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 male, male, right?
Yeah.
Earning more than 100 grand. This figure in Ireland has gone from 237,000 couples to 357,000 couples. So there's been a huge increase young people. Now, go back to our really rich couple, the 200 grand ones, right? Maximum they can borrow is 4 times their income, which is 800 grand. And LTV regulations mean that they also have to have saved 10% of some property value, which is 80 grand.
Yeah.
Even at that, at 800 grand, they are going to be buying ex-council houses. They are going to be ex-Artnell cottages in Portobello and these sort of places.
Yeah.
Which is completely bizarre. And if you go down from, let's say, the top 5% to the top 15%, which is those 300,000 odd who are collectively earning more than 100 grand, they can only borrow 400 grand. And that puts them into ex-council estates all over the country.
And of course, this is not just a Dublin thing.
It's all over the Western world, all over the English-speaking world.
Yeah.
And it's a total change from what we're seeing everywhere else in the economy, which is those things that used to be available to rich people only are now available to poorer people because of the dramatic increase in productivity in manufacturing and the dramatic fall in the price of manufacturing goods. And what we're seeing, it's basically the economic equivalent of Moore's Law, John.
Yes. Yeah.
Except for housing. And what we see then is poor people are moving further and further out of the cities, out into new suburbs. And the really poor people are moving into homelessness because there are no homes for them.
But of course, Mac, you know, remember we did that podcast on the Italians in Ireland. So as well as people moving up from the country during the famine, we also had an influx of the first wave of Italians at the time. So there's even more pressure on housing. So going back to something that you mentioned earlier about the Harold's Cross and Portobello, all that housing being built in response to what was effectively a refugee crisis, an internal refugee crisis. And here we are again. So what is the actual solution here? Like, we need something really urgent. But before you answer that, let's do a bit of this.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
So, Mike, it feels like history is repeating itself somewhat, where we've had housing crises before, and the one of the mid to late 19th century was brought on in part by the influx of people coming from rural areas and elsewhere. And then, as you mentioned, we had houses being built in the likes of Portobello and Harold's Cross and these kind of places by the likes of Guinnesses and the Quakers through the introduction of that Housing Act. But here we are again. So what is the actual solution here? Because this is really urgent, as we all know. And, you know, sometimes I feel like we're being gaslighted by ministers about how they're addressing the housing crisis.
Let's before we look at the solution, just let's take a little bit of altitude and see what is happening. In every aspect of the economy, there has been outrageous progress in your health, in your education, in quality of life, in life expectancy, in the consumer goods, in life experiences, all this sort of stuff has changed dramatically. One area where there has been not only no improvement, but we've gone backwards is housing. So as an economist, that tells me something is wrong in the way we're treating this asset, this dilemma. What we have succeeded in doing is created a rentier class. And that's the key. Far too much of the resources of society are going to housing. Far too much of people's incomes are going to housing. Far too much of people's long-term incomes are going to houses in the form of mortgages. What that does is it creates a drone class who own property and a worker class who work to pay rents or mortgages. So imagine you're in a beehive, John. You have the worker bees working away, making the pollen, making the honey, generating the whole thing. And then you have these drones who sit around, you know,
smoking cigarettes and stuff.
The bee equivalent of smoking spliffs, right? There's a bee equivalent. And just getting fat and rich and doing nothing. And then, of course, when that happens, all the resources of the economy go into the sector where you can get rich for doing nothing, which is the basic nirvana for all humans. How do you sit in your hole and get rich? How you do that is you buy property. And it's even better if you have immigration, and it's even better if you have an increasing population as we have, because all the poor workers, be they foreign or domestic, will fight each other to buy the homes.
Yeah.
And of course, then you create division because the poor people who actually leave the suburbs and end up out in provincial towns are already displaced.
Yeah.
And then you've got the immigrants coming in, and that sense of displacement is even bigger. So you get social problems, and it all comes back to housing. This is the whole thing, that you create a situation where we're taking money from young workers and we're giving them to old landlords. But more interestingly, we're giving them to from young workers who spend, and we're giving them to rich people who hoard. So one of the great myths and one of the great dirty little secrets that rich people never tell you is that rich people don't spend, right? They don't spend enough, which is why I've always said for a society, if you take a billion is 1,000 million. It's better to have 1 million people with 1,000 euros than 1 billionaire with 1 billion. Because that 1 billionaire will never, ever spend enough. So think of what's happening in the housing dilemma. Those who own houses and own apartments and own these assets get increasingly rich. They increasingly hoard their money, which is why there's an entire industry of financial services. What is financial services? Financial services is only a way of pushing rich people's money into a financial product and out of the real economy. So we're making a total Hames of everything. Why? Because we don't tax land. This is the key. So let's go back to Poverty and Progress, our friend Henry George, the book that outsold every other book in the 1880s and 1890s in the United States, except for the Bible. An amazing statistic, isn't it?
Henry George
said, you need to tax land in order to bring land into use. And what he was saying, and this is slightly counterintuitive, if you tax land and if you tax sites, what that will do is that will make the non-use of land, vacancy, dereliction, big holes in the ground that aren't being used, it will make that expensive. So by actually taxing land, you bring it into use. What you're doing is you're giving an incentive for the land to come into use. Then you think, okay, what else did he say? He talked about this idea that if a land in an area has increased in value, why has it increased in value? he said that it's always the case that the reason land has increased in value and property prices is because they are increased by other things. So take, for example, the difference between Darndale and Dublin and Dublin 4. The actual house in Darndale to build the house is the same as building a house in Dublin 4. Cost of materials, the cost of labor, all that stuff.
Yeah.
The difference is the value of the site, the land upon which the house is built. Now, what increases the land site in Dublin 4 over the land site in Darndale? For non-Irish listeners, Darndale is a working class area of North Dublin. Dublin 4 is where the Aviva is and all those things. And I mentioned the Aviva because the Aviva is an asset. It's where Vincent Hospital is. It's where UCD is. It's where all the good schools are. It's where the Dart is. It's with the best bus connections. So the land in Dublin 4 is being made valuable, not by the people who own the land, but by the state puts the services in all around it.
Yeah.
And in order to capture that upside, why should somebody who lives in Dublin 4 capture all the gains in the value of his or her land that have been actually generated by the rest of us? That's the key to George's idea.
That's why estate agents always talk about location, location, location.
Exactly, because Dublin 4 or Dublin 2 or all those areas are where we live in Dunleary, right? We live in Dunleary. There's a lovely Dunleary Harbour built by somebody else. There's the Dart built by somebody else. There's loads of good schools. There's loads of places to walk around the place. There's nice restaurants. We didn't create any of that, but we get the upside because people like living by the seaside.
There's also a lot of dereliction, has to be said.
Because it's not taxed. The reason we have dereliction is because it doesn't cost anything to leave something fallow.
Yeah.
So the George idea is you tax it. It suddenly puts a doubt in the head of the owner, which is, I better bring this into use. The more the land is used, the more the land is developed and built on, the lower the cost of housing. And you begin the process of rebalancing this bizarre situation where rich people buy poor people's houses.
Yeah.
You want to get to a situation where poor people are buying rich people's houses. That's the objective of economics, right? That poor people buy the houses today that used to be owned by and lived in by rich people yesterday. That's the objective. So we need to turn the whole thing around because it self-evidently makes no sense unless you are one of the people who are doing very well out of this. Now, let me go back to your Grafton barber.
Yes.
The reason there are so many upscale barber shops knocking around now is that the young people who used to be able to move out from their parents and rent a gaff or buy a gaff and get on the ladder and begin the process of becoming adults can't do that because they're locked out of the market.
Yeah, but getting a mullet is not progress.
But they are spending on experiences. That's why they're spending. That's why consumption is going through the roof in Ireland because all these young people have decent incomes. In our day, we spent those decent incomes on mortgages and rents. They're locked out because the prices are too high. So they are beflowering themselves, John. They are beointmenting themselves. They are looking fabulous. I know the rugby mullet has to be a most regressive step.
Totally.
You know that great, John, I'll leave you with the image. You know that great thing of the progress of man where we go from ape to start standing up? We're on the ground, we start standing up, and eventually we're upright. Progress of man. The rugby mullet suggests we are going backwards, right? That, in fact, we are going back to our gorilla-like status over the course of the next year. But,
and the more successful the rugby team, the worse the mullet.
I know.
Or the more severe the mullet.
The more severe, the more big Joe McCarthy. There's no cause for that. There's no cause for that. We're calling you out here on the podcast. Anyway, John, we'll talk to you next week.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.